It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, professional football has been flagged by scandal and controversy, but it's still the most popular sport in America. A sports reporter shares his take on why that is. First, the White House has signaled it will approve the release of a classified memo from House Intelligence Chairman Devin Nunes. The document alleges abuses of power by the FBI. Some lawmakers and high-ranking members of the FBI have been quick to condemn the memo and its release. The FBI even went so far as to release a rare public statement advising against the Nunes memo's release. According to news reports, President Trump believes the release of the document will discredit the Russia investigation that has cast a shadow on the first year of his administration. Paul Singer is with us now. He's Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon, Rob. How are you doing?
Good. Well, give us a quick 101 on this memo. I know we haven't seen the memo. That's the part of the big issue here. But what do we know about what's in it?
The gist of the memo is that Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee have summarized some of the information they have gathered as part of the investigation of the what we call the Trump-Russia investigation. This is the investigation into whether or not President Trump's campaign in some way colluded with Russian officials in 2016. The controversy over this memo is that the chairman of the committee, Devin Nunes, who at one point recused himself from the investigation because he had been accused of mishandling some classified information himself, is now sort of back engaged, and he had this memo drafted without the without the input of the Democrats on the committee. The Democrats all voted not to publicly release it because they say it involves a bunch of classified information that shouldn't be released and could damage the FBI's ability to do investigations. Now, what's interesting is the FBI, oddly, put out a public statement a couple of days ago saying, please do not release this memo. It would be incredibly damaging to the FBI. And they also went on to say it involves basically cherry-picking information out of the investigative files to make a case that the FBI did something wrong. But in fact, since they're not releasing the underlying files, the public won't have any way to sort of evaluate whether this information in this memo and the accusations in the memo are true or not.
Now, before Nunes and Intelligence Committee Republicans can release this, they needed approval from President Trump, right, or from the White House.
Right, right. Because you're dealing with information that is classified in some cases, they basically need approval from the White House to declassify some portion of it. And the president had the opportunity. They said they were going to give the president 5 days to review the memo to decide whether it should be publicly released. He has given every indication he's going to allow it to be released. We think the process, in case anybody cares, is that the White House will agree to release it and send it back to the committee, and then the committee can release it at will. Again, when I say committee, I mean the committee Republicans. Democrats say there's no reason to release it and have prepared their own memo analyzing some of the same information, which the Republicans did not vote to release. So that one, at the moment, cannot be seen by the public.
And there's been an argument from Democrats on that committee that since this was approved by that committee, by the Republicans on the committee to be released, it was changed. What was submitted to the White House was different. Republicans, Nunes' staff say, well, this is just some grammatical fixes and whatnot. What's the argument there?
Well, again, since we haven't seen any of these memos, we're all talking in a dark black box. But, you know, what we believe, the Republican argument is, and they don't deny that they made some changes to this memo after the committee had voted to release it, voted on party lines to release it. So here's your hypothetical question. Is it the same memo? And if it's not the same memo, does the committee have to vote again to release it? Now, I'm not sure it would make a whole lot of difference, right? I mean, the Republicans already voted to release it once. They'd vote to release the edited version a second time, but it would sort of delay the process further.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today about the controversial memo from the House Intelligence Committee. The Republicans on there, they want to release it. Looks like they're getting approval from the White House. Could come out, looks like, as early as tomorrow. Let's talk about the impact of this, Paul. It sounds like, again, there's a focus here on how the FBI got approval to monitor one of the people involved in the Trump campaign. Is this something that in and of itself would erode heavily the Mueller investigation, or is there a lot of stuff out there besides this that it wouldn't be directly affected?
But without attempting to try to take sides in this partisan fight, let me explain what's happening here. Obviously, the FBI and Robert Mueller are doing this investigation. It's a twofold investigation, it appears. One, was there some sort of involvement or collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian officials during the campaign? And two, did President Trump or anybody else in the administration attempt to squash the investigation, obstruction of justice? For Republicans, the focus of this entire thing has been, did the FBI improperly target President Trump and his subordinates? Was there wiretapping? Was there what they call unmasking? Were they trying to publicly embarrass Trump officials by releasing their names? Were there illegal leaks? Their argument is that it is the abuse of the president by the FBI that is the bigger deal. And so you have these two sort of warring message machines, one saying, we are very concerned that the president obstructed justice, and the other saying, don't believe the FBI, they're crooks.
And what have we been hearing from other Republicans in response to this, people not directly on this committee?
A mix of things, actually. In fact, my colleague Eliza Collins is at the Republican retreat in West Virginia this week, where she's getting a sort of a mixed bag. There are some Republican senators particularly who are concerned because they have not seen the memo. And they think maybe the House should hold off. They should share it with the Republican senators. Maybe it does require a little more review. Maybe the FBI should get a look at it, or the Justice Department should get an opportunity to make an official recommendation, because this whole thing is being done in a small group of people in the House Intelligence Committee. On the other hand, there are others in the Republican caucus who say, no, it's time to release this information. I will say that Paul Ryan, who your listeners are probably familiar with, said today that he believes this is not an attempt to disparage the FBI. It is simply an attempt to ensure that with these extraordinary powers the FBI has to seek a warrant on American citizens to eavesdrop on their conversations, that they're not doing it wrong, that they didn't misbehave, and that nobody in the agency misapplied their powers. He makes it sound like this is a very narrow inquiry into the possibility that somebody misbehaved, not that the FBI is full of, you know, crooked, corrupt people trying to undercut the White House.
Paul, you've been covering Washington for a time now. Are we kind of in uncharted territory here?
Yeah. In fact, at some point, I tweeted last week that, you know, I'm old enough to remember when the Intelligence Committee never made public statements about anything. And now it seems like every other day, one of the Intelligence Committee members, the chairman, the ranking member, gets up and accuses the other one of being a liar. Personally, I will tell you, as an American citizen, it does not generate great confidence in me to know that the committee responsible for overseeing our intelligence gathering is unable to have a civil conversation amongst its members. You'll note that the Senate Intelligence Committee is not having this problem. They are cooperating pretty shiningly, it seems. They are working on an investigation, and they're taking it pretty seriously, and they're not throwing rocks at each other.
We'll leave it there for now, Paul. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Have a great day.
You too. That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for the USA Today. He was with us today to talk about what looks like the likely release of a House Intelligence Committee memo authored by Republicans and their staff on the FBI and its role in the Mueller investigation. For the 42nd year in a row, football is the most popular sport in the United States. That's according to a new poll from Gallup. While the sport has lost some popularity since 2008, it's still the favorite, the number one sport, as reported by 37% of Americans, followed by basketball at 11%, baseball at 9%. This even though professional football has come under fire for domestic violence accusations against players, links to degenerative brain disease and head injuries, and political protests among its players. So why is football on the eve of the Super Bowl still the big game for Americans? Jason Wilde covers the Packers for ESPN Wisconsin. Jason, thanks for joining us today.
Happy to do it, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Well, we see these national trends. I mean, all sports viewership seems to be down, including football, but football still the big game in town. You've covered the Packers for years. Have you seen their popularity wax or wane over time?
No, you know, I really haven't. It's amazing how when they have a down season, like they did this year with Aaron Rodgers breaking his right collarbone and missing 10 games, the interest, I don't think, changes. I think the frustration level certainly changes. But, you know, maybe fans aren't quite as invested, but they still care very, very deeply about the Packers and are still spending a lot of their discretionary income on whether it's jerseys or tickets to games, a lot of times in the secondary market where they're really expensive, or even road trips to away games. I mean, one of the things that in the two-plus decades of covering this team that I've always been amazed by is just how well Packers fans travel, even to places that might not seem like fun vacation spots. They are always out in full force, and you know that that means they're spending a significant amount of money to travel there and buy the tickets and everything else.
Is there something about football that makes it a better sport, or at least a more appealing sport to Americans than, you know, all the competition that's out there?
Yeah, I've always kind of wondered that too, because I think it's pretty clear that even though we call baseball America's pastime, that the NFL really is America's game. And I think that's why there's so much attention on the uncertainty that is facing the game today. I mean, as you mentioned, you know, the viewership has gone down. Now, is that related to just how people younger than me consume television and they don't watch games, you know, the traditional same way that I have for my whole life when I turn the television on and I watch the game that way? Is that part of it? It certainly hasn't deterred the networks from bidding high for the rights to television to televise the NFL. I mean, the Fox Sports deal is over $3 billion to do the Thursday night package that they just signed. So there's obviously not significant concern among the TV networks about lost viewership. In terms of what it might be about the game itself, I don't know, because the concern that I would have if I was the NFL, and I think they do have it, is about the dangers of concussions and CTE and how that has changed maybe how the most popular sport in America is viewed. I know, as I look back on my career, I tell this story all the time, but I was covering a game early in my career, I think it was in 96, when Don Beebe was a wide receiver for the Packers, and he was knocked out in the first half with a concussion. Brett Favre remembers him snoring on the field after being knocked out. And he came back in the second half and caught the game-winning touchdown. And none of us in the media, fans, the team, none of us blinked an eye. None of us said, should a guy who was snoring on the field in the first half be on the field in the second half? And I look back and I think about my younger self and think, God, are you an idiot? How did you not think in these terms back then? But I was certainly not alone, and I know that they've for their own self-preservation, paid a lot more attention to concussions in the last decade or so, but they've got a lot of work to do if they're going to continue to protect their sports popularity.
Yeah, some hits not that long ago would have been ESPN highlights, you know, the big hits of the week. And then looking at the couple hits that Devontae Adams of the Packers took this year. I mean, nowadays watching it, I don't know if I would have reacted this way 10 years ago. I mean, I feel sick to my stomach sometimes seeing that. I still watch the NFL. I probably like a lot of people, but I don't want to see that.
Well, and Rob, I think you're typical of the enlightened NFL fan who looks at the dangers to these players and feels some measure of understanding and concern for their well-being. I would say, though, that every time I get into this debate on social media or we talk about it on our radio show, invariably there are those fans that will simply say, first of all, that, you know, it's almost like the ancient times in the Colosseum, and this idea that these guys are warriors and they're there for our entertainment, and they signed up for this, they know the dangers, and so they get paid very handsomely. And there's this segment of the fan base, I don't know how large it is, so if you get hit like that, too bad. And I'm not in that group. I'm not comfortable with that group. but there is definitely that group still in existence.
There's also concern we hear from parents. Those NFL guys are getting paid. My kid's playing pee wee or high school football. They're not getting paid. They may never get paid. They don't probably understand the risks being of that age. Is this something that you think is going to change people going into the game in the first place, make that pyramid of people playing football from early age on up smaller?
Well, I do, and I think the NFL does too. I think that's among their biggest concerns. I know, you know, I do our radio show with Mark Tauscher, who played 11 years in the NFL and played at UW, and his son plays peewee hockey, and I know for Tausch, it's a very difficult, we've talked about it before on the show, it's a very difficult line for him to walk because, you know, football has given him the life that he leads. And he loved playing football, and he loved the camaraderie and being teammates and experiencing the highs and lows with your guys and all the great things, you know, all the lessons that you learn from playing a team sport, not exclusive to football, in my opinion. At the same time, you know, I know he has concerns about, you know, long term. You know, he's 40 years old, and, you know, are there going to be symptoms that are going to show up later in his life? Because as a 300-pound guy colliding into another 300-pound guy, play after play after play on the offensive line, what impact is that going to have on him in terms of his life 20 years from now? And so I think for players that played the game, that's something that's on their minds. And then as parents, I think that factors in. I know Brett Favre not that long ago came out and said he's got two daughters, but he has three grandsons. And he said he doesn't want his grandsons to play football. I mean, for Brett Favre, one of the iconic players, not just in Packers history, but in NFL history, to say that he wouldn't want his sons to play football. Now, if they want to play, he's going to let them play. But the idea that he wouldn't encourage them, given what football did for him and the life that it created for him and how much he loves the game, if he's in a position where he feels that way, then how does a regular parent who doesn't have an NFL background look at this game and view it in terms of what prism do they view it through, as a sport that has all these benefits or as the sport that has the dangers that we all are learning more and more about each day?
We're talking to Wisconsin sports writer Jason Wilde about the continuing popularity of the NFL and challenges facing it. And Jason, some people, including the president, have pointed toward declining TV numbers for the NFL and said it's the politics. It's the taking a knee, not respecting the flag. On the other hand, when you look at numbers for other sports, NASCAR, their viewership has dropped a lot. They're not taking a knee there. How do you weigh the impact of that argument?
I understand where some folks are coming from on this. There's a very passionate group that sees this as incredibly disrespectful, that maybe doesn't quite appreciate the freedom of expression aspect to it. I know there's a sign on one guy's fence not too far down the street from Lambeau Field where he has posted a large sign that says, "Stand for the flag or pack your bag." And you see it when you drive down Lombardi Avenue here in Green Bay. I try to avoid on our show talking too much politics. I feel like people tune in to talk about sports. But I have been, in my own personal opinion, amazed at people that would feel so strongly about this and be so incredibly offended by players feeling their and using their right to demonstrate that you would not watch football, that you would give up something that you so enjoy watching for so long. My advice would have been just tune into the game a few minutes late and miss the national anthem and go back to your life. You can feel the way you feel, but I'm not quite on board with then you in turn protesting not watching games that have brought you joy as a fan for so long. I think a lot of this has gotten muddled, and I think that makes it difficult for all sides to understand where the opposite side is coming from. But in talking with players who did this or have supported this, I do believe that they feel very strongly about using something that can draw attention and start a conversation, and that's their thought process. And it has cost Colin Kaepernick essentially his livelihood. He chose to take this approach, and it obviously led to him not even playing in the National Football League last year.
And Jason, before we wrap up, I want to look at one other issue here, is that we have so many sports to choose from, and with cable and now, as you were saying earlier, streaming and whatnot, so many ways to watch them. So my kids are going up, they're watching a little bit of NFL, a little bit of basketball, the Olympics, sure, and they watch a ton of soccer, which we can watch from Europe now. The market is saturated with different sports options, so those eyes are going to go to different places now.
Yeah, and I do think it's interesting, you know, having kids of my own, and they love playing sports, and it's hard to get them to actually sit and watch sports. They don't, even gymnastics, which they love, they don't really sit and watch it. They're more participatory, and, you know, I don't know if that's a trend among kids or not. Fortunately, our kids don't spend a ton of time on, like, YouTube either, so I'm sure that cross will, we'll have to cross that bridge at some point.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
You know, I think for most people, it is interesting to see the different routes that you can take in terms of your interest. I mean, just speaking from my own experience, you know, I grew up with the big sports, right? The NFL, Major League Baseball, the NBA, and then college football and college basketball. When I got to Wisconsin as a student, you know, one of the first things I covered for the Badger Herald as a student was women's soccer at UW. And I think there's some appeal for a lot of folks, and I was that way with this, to do something or cover something or follow something or become a fan of something that you actually aren't as familiar with.
We'll leave it there for now. Jason, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
That's sports writer Jason Wilde. He joined us to talk about how football has weathered controversy over the past 40 years to keep its spot as America's favorite sport. As Americans, our identities are often defined by our careers. But what if we were also defined, at least in part, by our hobbies, the things we did outside of work, you know, for fun? Our next guest says that could actually make us happier. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What is your hobby, or what are your hobbies? Has taking up a hobby improved your life? Do you think of it as part of who you are? Do you have time for it with the challenges of work, family, all the other stuff? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also join us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Susie Nielsen's a writer. Her works appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Vice, and Quartz. She recently wrote about hobbies for TheCut.com. Susie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you so much for having me.
You write, Susie, that over half of us Americans get our sense of identity, at least in a big part, from our jobs. Is that saying something about us as Americans and where our preoccupations are?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this because, you know, I'm a journalist and I run with a crowd that's pretty work obsessed. and I guess, you know, I also went to kind of a university that stressed that, and I just think we get that kind of messaging a lot. In the piece I wrote about this advertisement that displays a woman who sort of looks super sleep deprived, and it's an advertisement for a sort of gig economy kind of job. The woman's expected to work around the clock, and the advertisement glorifies that. And I think that's a problem we kind of all have. We push each other to work as much as possible.
And you write that you were at a gathering and somebody asked, what do you do? And you gave the wrong answer, basically.
Yeah, it's so funny. I mean, it was kind of a culture shock. So I was in South Africa last year filming a documentary, and I went to this barbecue dinner with a couple of friends, and a South African woman asked me, what do you do? And I thought she meant, what do you do for work? Because that's kind of the knee-jerk response that every American has to that question. So I told her, you know, I'm a journalist, I work for a magazine, and she kind of looked at me with bemusement almost. It was kind of a shock, you know. I just assumed that that's how everyone answered that question. But I've since found, you know, I've been thinking back on it, and even when I've been in places like Spain or Australia, people have asked me that question, and it doesn't usually refer to what is your job, which tends to be the more boring answer. In other countries, people are really asking, what do you like to do? What sort of stokes your fire, or what do you find interesting? And usually when you answer in that way, it actually leads to a more interesting conversation and can often build a better relationship. So I just thought that was really interesting.
And I think we view the hobby that we have, whatever it might be, as maybe something kind of frivolous, maybe kind of goofy that we spend our time doing this. But you, right, you looked at some research and some expertise on this. Having that hobby or those hobbies, it can be serious stuff. It can have real benefits for us.
Yeah, you know, so I was really interested in the sort of psychology behind this. So I found this study by a Duke University professor, Patricia Linville, and she was looking at how different people react to stressors in their lives. And one example she gave was of somebody who identified themselves primarily through their work and their marriage. And say that person suffers a professional setback due to maybe a marital complication. If that person identifies just as a partner and just as a professional, then their what's called their self-concept is going to kind of take a much bigger blow than say if they identify themselves in a number of different lights. Like I've been trying to do this more because I definitely can fall into this trap, but I've been trying to think of myself, you know, I'm not just a writer, I'm also a singer, I like to sing, I like to go swimming, I'm also a sister and a daughter. And the more, the argument basically is that the more different kind of identity baskets you have, the less likely it is that one really big blow is going to knock you out.
And Susie, you mentioned that you've got a job that takes up a lot of your time and attention. Do you feel like you have time to do things like your singing or other hobbies?
Well, it's funny you ask that because I just reconnected with my old college band.
Wow.
Yeah, Juicy Fruit. I'm very excited. We're hopefully going to start rehearsing pretty soon. But I would say I'm actually in graduate school right now, and that can kind of be a draw on your time. But I find that even if I don't have time for, you know, a scheduled hobby, like twice or three times a week, taking up a few hours, just going for walks with friends or really putting some time into your relationships can really help with this. Because the more relationships you have, you have those sort of different selves when you're interacting with different people. And then even something as simple as like an exercise class that is fun and kind of gets you moving and meeting other people. I think we can all do it, you know. Everyone says, you know, I don't have time for this. But it's really about what you make time for. So if you really care about, you know, having a stable mental state, which I know, I mean, a lot of my peers actually kind of glorify this up and down way of living, but if you want to sort of take steps towards safeguarding your mental health, definitely reach out to more people and take some time to diversify your interests.
We're talking about hobbies and the value of having a hobby. Susie Nielsen is with us. She's written about this recently. We'll go to your calls now. Our listeners have hobbies, apparently, and want to share them with us. John starts us off in Nina. John, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What's your hobby, John?
My hobby is building drones, quadcopters and hexacopters. I'm 54 years old, and I found this hobby a couple of years ago. Looking at YouTubes, I bought one of the little tiny plastic toys, and it just has snowballed since then.
Now,
go ahead.
Were you mechanically inclined before this, John?
I'm an electrical engineer by training. and there's all sorts of YouTube videos, and there's all sorts of communities out there. I've got my favorite people I like to follow, and there's a lot of soldering, firmware upgrades. I mean, at the end of the day, you get a camera up in the air. It's a really a fun hobby.
And, John, do you have friends from this online and or in person?
Well, mostly online. The folks I work with, they don't get into the hobby. My kids, they can't stand going out with me to the field. One of the things of the hobby is you wreck the thing, right? And then you spend most of your time rebuilding it.
John, that sounds like a lot of fun. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And Susie, he started this, I mean, he had relevant experience as an electrical engineer, but he started this in his 50s, so we can discover these new hobbies whenever in our lives, really.
Yeah, that's really great. I actually, that reminds me of my uncle, actually, who lives in the Bay Area. He's recently started taking up woodworking, and he makes these amazing bowls, but he was not really artistically inclined before this. He started in his late 40s, and now he's selling them. So I think it's definitely possible to to take up hobbies later in life, even if it's not really in your field of expertise, but probably that helps.
John, thanks a lot for calling. We'll go next to Logan in Wisconsin Dells. Logan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your hobby, Logan?
Well, when I was a kid, I grew up in Appalachia, and our parents had a showing rabbit, like dog shows with rabbits. And we went all over the country from Rhode Island to Wichita, Kansas, to these national rabbit shows where there'd be 20,000 rabbits.
Wow.
And it completely changed my life as a kid. Coming from Appalachia, I was exposed to all different kinds of ways of living, and everybody from city slickers to farmers who spoke four languages, and just completely shaped my entire worldview, you know, that I grew into just from showing rabbits as a kid to being exposed to different people.
Do you still raise rabbits, Logan, or do you have new hobbies nowadays?
I don't raise rabbits anymore. I moved to Wisconsin a few years ago. I was supposed to be here for 3 months. Now I'm going on year four. And so I've been talking about going out and getting some rabbits, and there's a trio of American sable rabbits. It's this beautiful breed in Tennessee for $500 for the three of them. And I keep thinking, am I crazy enough to get back into this and drop $500 on three rabbits, drive down to Tennessee and pick them up? And I think I just might be.
All right, get back in the game, Logan. Thanks. And you can, of course, check out rabbits at all the county fairs, and especially the big state fair in the summer. There are a lot of people showing rabbits there. So, Susie, Logan is maybe on the cusp of getting back into his childhood hobby.
Oh, man, I hope so. That sounds like an incredible hobby. I'm a little jealous.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a big commitment once you go and pick those rabbits up, though. Logan, good luck with that if you do end up doing this. You can join in with your hobby, what it means in your life. Your questions about hobbies at 800-642-1234. Susie Nielsen is with us. She wrote a piece for thecut.com. It's called Why Hobbies Make You Happy. And we want to hear from more of you. What hobby do you have? Does it make you happy? Do you want to get back into something, or maybe try something new? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll pick up the conversation, get more of your calls coming up on Central Time. Back to your calls now. Carrie is on the line in Milwaukee. Carrie, hi.
Hi. I have too many hobbies to even list or have time for. I refer to myself as a voracious reader, an avid angler, a lover of all crafts, and last year I got back into woodworking,
wow,
building things. And I can attest to what you're talking about. I've been through, the last 6 years have been a very up and down period for me career-wise. But I've never completely lost my mind because I've always had something to do while I was looking for a job. You know what I mean? On the other hand, my husband had a job loss a few years ago, and he fell into a severe depression, like debilitating, for about 2 years. And, you know, I think we as a society, men are far more likely to identify themselves by their career and what their job title is. And it literally took away his sense of self, as you were discussing earlier. I know that if I'm out of work or something, I've always got something to fall back on. I mean, gosh, I can hopefully fill the freezer with fish if I need to. So it's a huge thing for me, and I'm really glad to see that there's some research around it, and I'm not just speaking anecdotally.
Thank you so much for sharing that, and good luck to your husband. I hope things have bounced back there. Susie, that really gets to a lot of what you're talking about. If we're too much bound into our job as our identity, I mean, job loss is bad enough economically, forget the identity part, but if it's our identity too, that's a really big loss.
Yeah, it actually made me think about, a lot of different sectors of the American economy are being turned over to AI, like, a lot of these self-driving cars, and the Amazon Go store just opened up in Seattle, and that will sort of, if that store model replicates, a lot of retail jobs will be gone. And I just keep thinking about how many people will have so much free time on their hands. And, I mean, barring the economic difficulties, the mental health stuff can actually make it a lot harder to look for a job. So that point is really important, I think, to keep yourself busy if you have all that time.
Thanks a lot for calling in. We'll go next to Paula on the line in Cambridge. Paula, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Paula?
Well, I, at age 47, realized a lifelong dream, and my primary hobby has been working with, I purchased an off-track thoroughbred.
Wow.
And with a lot of support, have trained her, and I'm still training her, but I've had her for almost 4 years now, and it makes me so happy and is so fulfilling, and I love her beyond reason.
Oh. And Paula, did you have horses around when you were a kid, or were you the kid who's like, I want a horse, but I get one someday, I'm going to get a horse?
No, I had worked at a stable and I had riding lessons, but I had never owned a horse. I begged for one and never got one. So this is the first horse I ever owned. But it has just, and you know, it's become a huge part of my social network. I share it with some of the younger females in the family. I ride with my great niece. And it just, it's when I'm stressed, I go to the stable. and I have a very rewarding job. I enjoy what I do, but there's just not been anything else in my life quite like this.
Paula, thank you so much for sharing that. Wow, so much there, Susie. Her social network, it brings her together with family members, it sounds like, and stress relief, plus fulfilling that lifelong dream all in one.
Yeah, what struck me actually is I'm starting to see a pattern here of people using hobbies to connect with their childhood selves, which I think really is an interesting layer to this whole self-complexity thing because, you know, work is this very grown-up thing. We become adults and we get all these responsibilities, but in doing that, we often lose kind of the sense of wonder and lightness of being a kid. And if you can have a hobby that connects you back with that, that's really amazing. I mean, that's how I treat singing, actually, because I was singing since I was three. Like, I was in musical theater and I did all that. So I resonate with that impulse, I guess.
That's interesting. Hobbies are often the things we give up to become adults.
Yeah.
Which is sad but happy when we come back. Yeah. Paula, thank you so much. I'll go next to Mike on the line in Appleton. Mike, hi.
Hey, it's good to talk to you. So I have more hobbies than you can name, but I started playing the five-string banjo when I was probably 14 or 15, and I'm 62 right now. And I worked my way through school, playing in bands and everything. Well, the long and the short of it is when I retired, I was finally able to play the banjo just because it sounds so beautiful, and I've grown just to love it, and I literally could play 4 or 5 hours a day and not even think about it. Then I draw, pen and ink and pencils, and I walk all over the woods, and the best thing about being retired is living in Appleton, I'm an hour and a half away from Door County, so I get to Door County about once a month, and it's just adventuring and new experiences and new feelings and a sense of mindfulness. And when I play the banjo, especially, I'm a different person, in a different state, and it's not about making money anymore. It's about the love of the sound.
Fantastic, Mike. Thank you so much. And Susie, a lot there, but he's retired now. And that makes me think, you know, we talked about job loss, but you hear people sometimes they're at loose ends after they retire, especially if work was everything that life was built around. That's going to be a critical time, I would imagine, to find a good hobby.
Definitely, yeah. Actually, that makes me think about, so my stepdad actually retired a few years ago, and he's the kind of person that can't really be sitting around doing nothing. Like, he's kind of a compulsive doer, and this is less of a hobby and more of a really big project, but last summer he decided he was going to bike across the U.S.
Wow.
He made it 4,000 miles over 3 months, I think, and it was so fun. I joined him on a leg or two of it, and it was so fun to watch how he, he was just over the course of the trip, he started relating to the world so differently, and I think that touches on what you were just speaking about, with the sort of, I feel like the more multi-sensory your hobbies can be, like playing music or going on an adventure, sort of broadening yourself out beyond, you know, your office or like the screen of a computer, which is often, I mean, that's a lot of the jobs we have today.
Mike, thank you so much for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. We're talking about hobbies with writer Susie Nielsen. Back to your calls. Ashley is on the line in Madison. Ashley, hi.
Hi. So I was calling because I am a mother of a two-year-old and twin seven-month-old. And with this second pregnancy, I've had been affected by postpartum depression and anxiety. And something that my therapist and my doctor said was that I needed to get back in touch with me, find an identity outside of being, you know, my job and being a mother. And so I've started taking Tai Chi classes through the City Rec program. And something as simple as taking 30 minutes a couple times a week to close the bedroom door and read a book of my choosing without having to think about anything but myself. And I have found that has been very rewarding and rejuvenating for me as I work through the postpartum depression and anxiety.
Ashley, I'm so glad you found those hobbies to help you through that. Susie, finding space for herself. I mean, that's a lot of what people are doing, I guess, with hobbies.
Yeah, definitely. And I think something like reading, which can sort of transport you into a different world where you don't have all those responsibilities, because that's what work is. It's being responsible for often a lot of different people and a lot of different tasks. And a hobby that can sort of just take you out of that universe can be so, so helpful.
Ashley, thanks for that call. In our last minute or so, Susie, we were talking earlier around the office today. Maybe hobby, it sounds like a trivial word. Do we need a better word?
I think so. I think even the word hobby, it sounds so sing-song, you know? Like, I just kept thinking in this article when people asked me about it, I would say, you know, I wouldn't say I was writing about hobbies. I would say I was writing about self-complexity, because I think that's really what it is. It doesn't have to be, like I said, a scheduled activity, and it doesn't have to be like wood carving, although that's a really cool one. But as long as you're kind of taking the time to check in with yourself in a way that's not like a productivity machine, I think that's what's really important, to just really remember that you're not living to work. You have a life outside of that.
Yeah, people we won't have time to get to. We've got Kelly on the line who paints, Emily who is a Lego builder, Andy emailed. He builds and customizes motorcycles, and we a lot of people out there with things. Are you inspired, Susie, to make sure you make time to hang out with the band and do some singing?
Oh, definitely. I'm going to do that this weekend. I'm going to text my friend Austin as soon as I get off the phone with you.
Fantastic. Susie, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rob. It was a pleasure.
That's Susie Nielsen. She joined us to talk about her recent piece for The Cut. It's Why Hobbies Make You Happy. Well, still time for you to tell us about your hobby. You can do that on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. What is your hobby? Your pastime, whatever you want to call it. Did you ever wonder what would happen if you went straight down into the earth and came out the other side, apart from all the magma burns? A colleague here at WPR pointed out to me a fun website that gets us in touch with the other side of our planet. It's called the Antipodes map. It looks like antipodes. I looked it up. It's Antipodes, where you can find the spot on the earth that's the exact opposite of another place. Like, if you could dig directly down all the way through the earth, where would you come out? So I took it for a spin. If I went straight down where I'm sitting right now, I would come out in the Indian Ocean. So let's try some other spots around the state. If we start in Milwaukee, we'd come out in the Indian Ocean. If you go west to La Crosse, Indian Ocean, up north to Superior, you get the picture. It's the Indian Ocean. Turns out the Indian Ocean is really big. All of Wisconsin would come out to there. A little kind of to the south, you'd be west, well west of Australia. Actually, all of the continental United States. Yeah, we'd all come out in the Indian Ocean. So it turns out this website was less fun than I thought it would be. But maybe we need some kind of preparedness. Like, if some weird thing were to happen where suddenly we're all transported, we need, like, to have water wings or life jackets or rafts with us all the time. Probably won't happen. Something to think about. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Democrats are targeting the Republican who prepared the controversial memo alleging surveillance abuses by the FBI. NPR's Ryan Lucas.